From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, it's the week in review and continued scandals at the state police.
It's clear that the state police is going to have to work back some of that public credibility that's been sacrificed by some of these really bad actors.
Also, remembering novelist Anita Shreve, the beloved New England writer, died yesterday. Last year, she told us about the phone call from Oprah Winfrey that changed her life.
And the next thing I heard was Oprah's voice.
Ah!
Booming. I mean, you know, she goes, Anita. And I said, hi. And she said, I loved your book. And I said, thank you.
Plus, Love Letters columnist Meredith Goldstein on the ups and downs of having such a popular advice column.
I met this guy at a bar and brought him back to my apartment. But our night was just me giving him relationship advice in my bed about his ex.
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and it is Friday, so let's jump into the week in review, starting with yet another state police scandal. Here's Boston Globe investigative reporter Todd Wallach.
They publicly claimed, and they've told me in writing multiple times, that every single state police employee was listed in the payroll records, and we now know that's not true.
Well, we spoke to State Comptroller Tom Schack, who oversees the state's payroll records. He says someone had to know that those state police records were missing.
You know, no matter what, you had to be aware, that person or those people had to be aware of the fact that they were doing something that was wrong.
In fact, that's also what Governor Charlie Baker said.
Oh, I think it was clearly deliberate for some reason. I don't know what that reason was. It was in 2010.
So there's agreement that something isn't quite right here. But the question is what to do about it. Here's Attorney General Maura Healey.
I think this is a matter of transparency, accountability, and I think it's time that the Baker administration take a leadership role in this issue.
Well, there is much to discuss, and joining me to do so is Michael Curry, former president of the Boston NAACP and a member of the National NAACP Board of Directors. Michael, it's great to see you again.
Great to be here.
Also with us is Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Jim, wonderful as always.
Good to be with you.
Okay, Michael, you get first crack at this. The Globe's investigative reporting that State Police Troop F, for years, was never actually put into payroll records for the state. And so some $32 million were spent that we didn't really know anything about.
Yeah, I mean, it's disturbing. I think it's a pattern we see across the country. And it comes up every so often, no matter what agency you're talking about. And the reality is that these officers, and particularly this troop, was taking advantage of these exorbitant hours and this payout. And we now need to figure out what that is. I think, you know, it's funny. I've often talked about this issue that we think cops are perfect and they don't do bad things, as played out across the country with police-involved shootings. Cops can do bad things, too. And it's important that we weed this out and figure out where this is coming from. I believe, and I think as the governor and others, that this was intentional and unacceptable.
Yeah. So let's play a couple pieces of tape here before I get to you, Jim, from the state comptroller, Tom Schack, who Deb Becker here at Radio Boston spoke with earlier this week. And first of all, he told us that for Troop F, Massport paid Troop F separately from the rest of the Massachusetts state police because Massport was paying them rather than the state police budget. But here's what Tom Schack said about this.
This wasn't something that just started in 2010. This is an agreement that was in place between Massport and the state police that dated back to the 1970s.
Not that it makes it okay that they didn't make it into the state records. Here's what the comptroller says about that, that something slipped through the cracks.
The requirement isn't filing with our office the data. The requirement is for us to publish the state payroll. And if we're unaware that there are state employees that are on a separate payroll system, then it's impossible for us to know, number one, that they are to be reported.
Okay, so Jim, where does the ultimate responsibility lie here?
So we've had a lot of political tit-for-tat where the governor pushed it toward the AG. The AG we just heard pushed it back towards the governor.
Yeah.
Look, in all of this, I don't think anyone's looking very good. What I would say, there should be systems in place for this sort of thing. So the first thing I'd say is the state auditor, right, to bring in a third person. However, the state auditor by law is supposed to actually look at every single agency and do an audit every 2 years. This is something that should be picked up in audits. There should be some that we should be looking for this all the time. I could just imagine how frustrated Tom Schack is, who's highly professional. He wants to make sure this is a person who's built on the Patrick administration's legacy of creating transparency websites. He's actually developing much more transparency, and this flies in the face of everything he does. So I would say the auditor really needs to get on this. I think the governor really needs to get on this and own this and say, we're going to look, if it's happening at Troop F, it's very possible it's happening well beyond that in terms of not disclosing all of the shifts and all the OT overtime, This is something, as Michael was saying before, and let me just extend a little bit beyond that. Certainly police can do bad things. We all do bad things.
Right.
But the problem is when you have a system in place that's not catching really egregious $32 million, $230,000 per police officer, when we're not catching that stuff, it's bigger than just one or two or 20 police officers who are gaming the system.
Yeah. I mean, so to your point about perhaps this is a moment for Governor Baker to step up. I mean, at the top of the segment, we heard him say that, yes, he believes it was deliberate, but he doesn't know why, because it was in 2010, a.k.a. not on his watch. I mean, I think that's the kind of thing that even people who are his most ardent supporters are saying, no, this is one that you can own. You can fix this. This should be a very fixable problem, right?
Absolutely. But I would say just one other thing. I mean, the Attorney General is also defending the state police. The Globe has two different public information requests for the state police on related matters, and she's defending that. So, I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on. We need systems in place to periodically check on each and every one of these agencies to make sure they're doing right by us.
Right. So, Michael, I hope this doesn't get me in trouble with people, but part of me looks at this story and like, because all of you, both of you pointed out the governor, the attorney general's office, the state police, Massport, the comptroller, the auditor. It feels to me that it's sort of writ large one of the problems, like the sort of internecine nature of Massachusetts government also, that it's a very impenetrable little world that occasionally we get some sunlight shown in, in this case, thanks to the Globe, and it's not pretty what we find. I really want a clear voice coming out of this saying, nope, I'm going to take responsibility and I will fix it. But who's that person going to be?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, it should be the governor. And I think, and I'm actually surprised because I've worked with Charlie Baker, and I think that that's probably inevitable that it will come, that he'll own this and it shouldn't be passing it back to any prior administration. Two, we have a system of quasi-public agencies and the whole reporting between Massport back to the state police makes no sense. So it actually is overdue that they're finally taking that back in, and payroll should be paid out from the state police and reporting should come through the state police. That's outdated. And even though it dates back, it doesn't make sense. MassDOT being the other one, which apparently they report directly. It's the way we work in Massachusetts. We have these quasi-publics. We have all these systems that don't talk, don't connect. We have multi-reporting agencies. Ultimately, the governor needs to make sure that anyone who works for the state is paid appropriately and is honest in their reporting.
Well, so one more thing about this. The Maura Healey's office has a statement that says, our office is investigating alleged criminal violations related to overtime abuse amongst members of Troop E. That's separately, right? The separate and concerning allegations regarding Troop F demonstrate a serious lack of transparency. And she says the Baker administration needs to take ownership of the problem. But I wanted to just remind everyone that back in 2015, just a couple of years ago, a nonprofit group called Investigative Reporters and Editors gave the Massachusetts State Police their Golden Padlock Award, the one that they give to what they call the most secretive public-funded agency or person in the entire United States.
Right.
So, I mean, as we know,
congratulations.
Gavin would agree with that too, right?
So, I mean, the state police have had some problems here. And I guess what I'm saying is I'll take an answer from either of you. At what point in time do we really do need some sort of more, if not permanent, semi-permanent oversight of the state police's operations?
Well, I guess just to build on Michael's point, the governor needs to own it now. Over time, we should have systems in place, and I do believe that lies primarily with the state auditor, because by law, that's what that office is supposed to do, to check in with these people every 2 years. This should have been ferreted out a long time ago. Fact is, this state as a whole is horrible on transparency. We have state legislative committees that can go into private mode whenever they want. I mean, we have statements of financial interest that are worthless. I mean, all kinds of stuff. But the state police is a cut above.
And I know Suzanne Bump. She's probably meeting right now all over this and thinking about it. And then I think, too, I have confidence in the legislature. I think that they'll convene groups to have a conversation over these transparency and accountability issues, and we'll get to it.
until the light gets turned on them. All due respect, friends listening. All right, let's talk about some good stuff coming out of the legislature. Turning now to Beacon Hill and criminal justice reform.
We know that criminal justice reform will reduce recidivism. We know that it will increase public safety, and we know that it will provide significant cost savings to the taxpayer.
That's Claire Cronin, House Chair of the Joint Committee on the Judiciary, speaking last Friday at the unveiling of the House Senate compromise bill in Massachusetts on criminal justice reform. We've got a little bit more tape here. Here's Senator William Brownsberger, co-author of the legislation.
The agreement that we've reached today is about lifting people up instead of locking them up. It's about cutting the chains that hold people down when they're trying to get back up on their feet. And it is about better protecting the public from drugs and guns.
So, Michael, this is a very large reform effort on Beacon Hill. Lots of provisions in it, such as eliminating some mandatory minimums for a bunch of different offenses. The governor hasn't yet taken a position on it, but it might get voted on in the beginning of next month. But your thoughts on this compromise effort?
Yes, I reflect back on when Senator Rosenberg first got selected as the Senate president, and unfortunate with all that he's going through. But he convened a group of us in his office, and Lou Finfer, who's an activist and around the community, Noah Berger, who's at Mass Budget Policy Center, about 20 of us in the room to talk about what are the key issues from a progressive standpoint we need to do. This was on the table.
Yeah.
Then you had the Black and Latino Legislative Caucus looking at mandatory minimums and pushing. So there's been a lot of work behind this by activists and faith leaders that now has culminated into this moment of a bill being passed. It's not what we wanted. But addressing fines and fees and mandatory minimums, at least five particular offenses with mandatory minimums, the caretakers, and making sure that we can get families, the primary caretaker, back to their families. All of this is progressive. And quite frankly, the Massachusetts that we claim to be, we should be trying to do this, and it should have been done many years ago. So kudos to them.
Yeah, so some of the other aspects of the bill, removing juvenile court jurisdictions over children age 7 to 11 so they don't face criminal sanctions. But then on the other end of things, because of the opioid crisis, making it easier to prosecute traffickers of fentanyl. And then would raise, for example, threshold for felony larceny from $250 in cash or goods stolen to $1,200. So raising essentially the felony cutoff threshold there. Jim, your thoughts?
Look, I think it was a good debate. I think, as Michael said, there were a lot of voices that went into it. I especially appreciate Will Brownsberger's his way of de-escalating all the debates. I mean, there's a lot of passion here, sometimes really loaded language, sometimes some pretty tough pushback, especially from law enforcement folks. Mm-hmm. And I think he took it all in the right spirit, and the people who were working out took in the right spirit to say that law enforcement folks are trying to be as honest as possible. There are a lot of thorny issues in there. I mean, I'll give you just one example, and that is expunging and sealing records is, while really important, a very thorny thing for an employer who may be putting other employees at risk, may not, and these are things that they think about. So there's a lot there. I would say it felt a little bit too sprawling at times. There's some things that are drawn into it that are highly controversial, the Romeo and Juliet provision, for example. It felt like it didn't rise to the level of many of the other things in here that are really super important to get right. This is the pendulum swinging. While Massachusetts is not the state with the highest incarceration, we're at the very back end of it in the United States. Historically, we're about three times where we were in the late 70s.
Right.
By international standards, we're pretty high. So I just hope that people continue to keep an eye on this from an empirical perspective. If we see things swinging back in the wrong direction, we should look at each and every one of those provisions to make sure that we maintain safe communities, because people of color and poor people are the primary victims of a lot of crime. So we just want to make sure we do both things well.
I think it's interesting. If you bring this bill into the conversation, bring in the DA in Philadelphia, Krasner, and the transformational work that he's doing there to address mass incarceration, laying off DAs who don't buy into this more progressive approach and this reform that he's put in place. Then you talk about Dan Connolly and his departure and the potential new DA. It's just a change coming. You can feel it coming. And I think this bill, along with those other things, means that the pendulum has swung. And for me, many folks like myself and communities of color who know that we've been tough on crime and not smart on crime, this is long overdue.
So, I mean, to the point about some of the state's DAs pushing back against this bill. That is indeed the case. On Friday, though, Suffolk District Attorney Daniel Conley said in a statement that a complete analysis of the bill is going to take some time, but it clearly reflects some thoughtful work and compromise. But before we leave this entirely, Michael, I just wanted to get your thoughts, because Jim brought up an interesting point that maybe some of the – there are certain aspects of the bill that, as you know, the DAs and other members of law enforcement do take issue with. And I just wanted to hear what your thoughts are on the strengthening laws to seal and expunge old convictions that Jim brought up.
Yeah, so there's been work going on. And I, coming out of law school, I know even lawyers and law schools have been working to try to do sealing and expunging records. It's actually a lot of work that legal organizations do. It's necessary. Now, there's always a fear that you can go too far with this stuff. But I think the reality is that most of these folks and most of these cases are nonviolent. They're offenses that we can get people back to work, back in their families, back in the communities, back into public housing if they need to get back. So Bill McGonigal at MHA would attest to that. We need to figure out a way to do this smart. So expungement, sealing, the Romeo and Juliet provision, I know Dan Conley expressed some concerns around that. We can work all of that out, but people have to be willing to come to the table and compromise, and it looks like we finally have done that.
Well, to your point, Jim, about the pendulum swinging, you know, hopefully here, at least in Massachusetts, we'll be able to get it to swing to a just and fair and safe place for everybody. So I want to talk about another thing. This one actually takes us to the federal level, but I'm very curious to hear what both of you think, and that is the fact that the Trump administration, the Commerce Department, has announced that it, on the 2020 census, wants to ask people about their citizenship status. Now, Attorney General Maura Healey announced this week that Massachusetts is joining a multi-state lawsuit to block that. Here's the lead on the lawsuit, New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman.
Up until now, Republicans and Democrats alike have tried to conduct as full and fair a count as possible. The Trump administration is breaking with that tradition.
Now, Schneiderman's argument is that asking about citizenship violates the Constitution and would suppress participation in the census. But Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross disagrees with that. Here he is on Fox Business on Tuesday.
Justice Department feels they need it so that they can enforce Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which protects minority voters.
Okay, Jim, your thoughts.
Gosh, there's politics going on. Look, I'm not a lawyer, so talking about whether it violates the Constitution or not is something I can't really opine on, except to say that the long form version of the census has for a long time included questions like this, but it's not really been applied to the short form for 60 years or so.
1950, yeah.
So this is clearly an attempt to get at blue states with high levels of either illegal or undocumented immigration. And whether they say it's a deterrent to people participating in the census or not, it will have that practical effect. That's just obvious, I think.
Yeah. Well, so here's Secretary of State Bill Galvin, who agrees with you, Jim.
This is an effort at sabotaging the census, and I think it's a political motivation. This is not about an accurate count.
Michael?
Yeah, it always reminds me in the political process when people say that old phrase is chess, not checkers. And with this administration, it is absolutely the highest degree of chess. And the reality is that state funding, the whole redistricting process relies on the count. The count is important, especially to underserved and poor communities and funding for health care and other things. There is a serious impact of this. I think it feeds into a broader narrative about the census under this administration, where you have organizations like the NAACP and others about to sue the census. I think we've already filed about the underfunding of even the process to do the count. So there is, the census becomes a tool to really damage these blue states, and it's playing out. And whether we're conscious and we can actually do things through the courts to stop it, we'll see.
So I'm just going to go out there, and when Jim said it smells like politics, I would agree, because I'm just going to put on my Captain Obvious cape here and say, to hear the Trump administration say that it's doing this to, you know, passionately defend the Voting Rights Act stretches credulity. Michael.
Yeah, I saw Biden talk about the prostitution of the Second Amendment. This is a perverse use of the Voting Rights Act for something that makes no sense. I think, it's funny. You can get so frustrated by this stuff, you turn your TV off, you don't open your paper because it just doesn't make any sense. And this is another misuse of the Voting Rights Act and the to attack our census process. Yeah. So,
you know, I have to say I don't necessarily struggle with this, but I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of folks who say no, only citizens should be counted, because over the course of this week, when I was hosting over at Here and Now, talking to some folks on the national level, I heard from a lot of voices who said that. Like, you know, it's citizenship in the United States that matters and citizens who should be counted. But I just can't quite wrap my head around that, because that's just in denial of the tens of millions of people who are also living here, who make up the fabric of the United States. So I don't know. I don't really have a question for you, Jim, but I just wanted to reflect on that with you.
I did a lot of
people
reading.
People really feel passionately about that.
Right. And I did a lot of reading around articles by people who are defending this, just to kind of say, what are the set of arguments? And I think the things I came away with, and I think people should know what the arguments are, is that the presence of illegal and undocumented residents gives an unfair boost. That's a term I've heard, I read often, to the political power of jurisdictions like California, New York, or Massachusetts, which are in some ways either sanctuary states or trying to act in that way. So they're saying, well, California has much more power than they really should have because these are undocumented or illegal immigrants.
Well, California, 10% of California workers are undocumented.
Completely
agree.
It's
a huge number. Yeah.
I guess I'm only saying this to say people in this country, we have to actually talk to each other and understand what is the underlying premise of things in order to actually have a rational conversation, be able to talk to each other and actually get along and get somewhere.
Right.
So but it will act as a deterrent, and that's absolutely clear. And if folks view the census as a vehicle to count every single resident, it will be a deterrent.
Yeah. Well, there's one more sort of state-level politics story that I just want to touch on really briefly, because the story broke yesterday. And that is Brian Hefner, partner of Senator Stan Rosenberg, was indicted yesterday by a grand jury on charges of sexual assault, criminal lewdness, and distributing nude photographs without consent. And of course, Brian Hefner also is the heart of the epicenter of the concerns around Senator Stan Rosenberg that lost him the presidency of the Massachusetts State Senate. And so he's now, again, Hefner has now been indicted. And Michael, I just wanted to get your quick thoughts on that, the ongoing story.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's funny because I'm a fan of former Senator President Rosenberg's, and it's all unfortunate. But it is, again, the influence peddling that some will do using loved ones, and some will do who are in elected office. It is a tragedy at its best, and another example of where we need to be vigilant, transparent, and seek accountability to make sure this stuff doesn't happen. And, of course, is sexual assault and the Me Too awareness that we're in right now. Just another example of how bad society is with this culture.
Hmm. Yeah. Jim, do you have a thought?
I mean, the only thought is, obviously, given the backgrounds of both the former Senate president and his husband as foster children, this is a truly a sad story. I would say, and this may sound harsh given where we are, so forgive me if it does, but, you know, I speak kind of plainly. I find it hard to believe the former Senate president, when he was being forthright in asserting that there was a true firewall between his husband and the activities of his office when he had access to the calendar, emails, and all kinds of stuff like that. So that, for me, is the saddest part.
Yeah. Right. No, I mean, and actually, I'm glad you brought it up, because he did say that. Rosenberg did say that multiple times, and
yes,
it is an ongoing question here. Okay, but it is Friday, so I would like to end on a slightly more whimsical note, if we could, and our hubbubs. Whimsical, or at least not quite so heartrending. Michael, your hubbub.
My hubbub would be an article that came out recently about entrepreneurship is waning in Massachusetts, and these businesses in name of only, they call them Beanos. Those are the Ubers and these other organizations where people create these businesses that don't really employ a lot of people. They may not pay taxes and all of that. And I think it's an interesting thing about where our economy is going with these Beanos.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Okay, so that was a little more serious than I had hoped for, but it's good to be kept informed about that. Jim, you're up next.
Mine is it's dark. Okay, my hubbub is about Munchkingate.
And the two, Munchkingate.
Munchkingate. No, you haven't even heard of it. That's how far down below the fold it was. The 2 days of placement of on the Globe's homepage for the story that Gisele Bündchen cannot stop after one munchkin and has to eat 10, which raised a calorie-burning question, like, whatever happened to the TB12 nutrition manual? It's a cookbook, right? Maybe this happens when you get it for free. You don't pay attention to it. I hope Tom gave Gisele the TB12 nutrition manual for free. Maybe I need a little sweetening up and a few more munchkins in my diet, but there is a serious side to this, which is hubbubs, as I said, are meant for below the fold. This should not have been on that homepage even one day. It's really getting hard to watch what yes. news organizations are doing in their search wow. for eyeballs.
Oh, okay. You brought it back down home. I was gonna say, like, I'm so happy to hear this news because it means like Giselle is like normal human being like the rest of us. But now you've made it into an insight into the slow downfall of journalism. Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Jim.
Love that time.
All right. So my hubbub is gonna end with another flaming disaster. Because I want to talk about this Chinese space station that's
yes.
going to come crashing to Earth now, possibly on Easter Sunday, which is also the 1st of April, I think. Yes, right. I've got my April 1st, right. So this is not an April Fool's joke. A Chinese space station's orbit is currently degrading around planet Earth. But the thing that I love the most is that it will probably land somewhere between, I don't know, what is it, 45 degrees north and roughly 45 degrees south. So
Anywhere
on planet Earth, in other words, and the Chinese don't have control over it. 90% of the space station is probably going to burn up in the upper atmosphere.
Yeah.
So the chances of a piece of space junk actually hitting you, they're saying, is less than one in a trillion or several trillion. So slightly worse than the mass state lottery odds. But nevertheless, keep your eyes open over the skies this Sunday, and you might see the remnants of a Chinese space station.
Yeah. They say look up in the sky, it's a bird or a plane, or it's a space station.
Or it's a space station, exactly. Michael Curry, former president of the NAACP in Boston. It was so great to have you. Thanks so much, Michael.
Thank you.
And Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Thank you as always, Jim.
Have a great weekend.
We'll be back. I'm Meghan Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghan Chakrabarty. New England novelist Anita Shreve told us last year that writing was a calling for her. And oh, how she answered that call. Some 20 books, including the bestsellers The Pilot's Wife and The Weight of Water. Shreve announced last year that she had cancer. And yesterday, she died at home in New Hampshire. She was 71. My work is a marriage of story and language that I think is almost ancient, she told the Boston Globe in 1998. That's the tradition I would like to be seen in. One of my favorite comments from readers is, "You ruined my night. I stayed up all night reading, and I was late for work." Shreve was a literary author who connected with popular audiences with her keen emotional insight. And in 98, she went from being best-selling to stratospheric when Oprah Winfrey chose The Pilot's Wife for her book club. Anita Shreve's life, like her fiction, was firmly rooted in New England. She grew up in Dedham and graduated from Tufts University. And last year, just before she went public about her cancer, Anita Shreve spoke with Radio Boston's Tanya Mosley. She just published what would become her final novel, The Stars Are Fire. So we wanted to listen back to that conversation.
Fans of your work know that New England seems to be the backdrop of a lot of your work. What draws you, besides this being your home, to this part of the world?
Well, I seem to be particularly drawn to Maine. There's something about the character of the people, and this is a generalization, but the character of the people seem to meld with the landscape, with this kind of flintiness of character that echoes the jagged rocks and the view of the sea. And it's a particularly wonderful place to set a story.
This book takes place in 1947 in Maine.
Yes.
And it centers around a woman, Grace Holland, who is in a dutiful but loveless marriage.
Yes.
What is the inspiration, or what was the inspiration for Grace's character?
Well, Grace's character, you know, she's fictional, but I based her on my mother. I mean, I remember how she couldn't drive, so her whole life was circumscribed by the neighborhood. Everything had to take place in the neighborhood. I remember my father coming home on Thursday night, and we would go to the grocery store once a week because he'd just gotten his paycheck. I could see her, you know, doing all her chores, which took all of her time except for 1.5 hour when she did watched her soap operas.
Wow.
It was an era in which women really were contained.
Talk to me about why that's a theme that we often see, like this inner turmoil with an individual character, most likely a woman, and then coming into her own.
It almost started with The Weight of Water, although it was true of books before that. In the Weight of Water, there's a line, and it says, if you push a woman to the edge, how will she behave? Mm. And that, to me, is a fascinating question when you take a perfectly normal woman, mm-hmm. and then she is faced with either a catastrophe or a situation that is just unbearable. How does she behave when she's pushed to the edge? And, of course, I choose the resilient woman because otherwise I wouldn't have much of a story if she just collapsed.
I'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the pilot's wife. So for many people, you had been writing for quite some time.
Right.
By the time Oprah kind of plucked you from
yes.
Massachusetts, from New England, and said, hey, we want to make the pilot's wife a book club book. That became just a huge thing for every author who was chosen for
yes.
Oprah's book club.
Yeah, she did for me. I was number 23 of 46, so I was right in the middle. And she did for me what she did for every book, which is send it right to the top of the New York Times bestseller list within 24 hours. And that was certainly something I had never imagined would happen. The most stunning thing for me personally was the night I got the phone call.
Mm-hmm.
And what had happened was somebody in her office had been calling me all day, but I wasn't there. I had gone to Portsmouth to do something there. And this was before the cell phone.
No cell phone, right?
No cell phone.
Yeah.
So there was no way my husband could reach me. And I was 2 hours late getting home. And he was fit to be tied. And he said, somebody has been calling from a book club, a little literary book club in Chicago.
Just a little book club in Chicago.
No, he meant it. That's what they had said. And wants to get hold of you. And you better call him right back because he's been driving me crazy. So I went to the phone in my coat and picked up the phone. And, you know, this man got on the phone and said, oh, I'm so glad you called. My boss wants to speak to you. Bam, put me on hold. And the next thing I heard was Oprah's voice. Booming. I mean, you know, she goes, Anita. And I said, hi. And she said, I loved your book. And I said, thank you. And then all of a sudden, I realized what the implications were. And it
right
was.
Then.
Yeah. Yeah. And there were, you know, you're only
right
allowed
then,
to tell
yeah.
one person besides your editor and your agent. And my husband was across the room and there were kids in the room. So I had to temper my excitement somewhat so that they wouldn't be saying, what?
That's New England novelist Anita Shreve speaking with Radio Boston's Tanya Mosley last year. Now, the day after Anita Shreve had this conversation with Tanya, she announced that she had cancer. Shreve died at home in New Hampshire yesterday. She was 71. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to this Friday edition of Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Meredith Goldstein is here. Back in 2009, she launched the Boston Globe's Love Letters column, and it quickly became one of the Globe's most popular. But through all that time, dishing out the sometimes funny, sometimes straight, always smart advice, Meredith herself didn't necessarily have it all together. A breakup with a coworker, her mother's cancer diagnosis, Meredith struggled with the question, how could I be helpful to readers if I could no longer be helpful to myself? Well, she tells us that whole story in her new memoir, Can't Help Myself, Lessons and Confessions from a Modern Advice Columnist. And she joins us now. Meredith, it is great to have you back.
I'm so excited to be here.
Congratulations on the memoir.
Thank you.
It is very brave. You let it all, you're like letting people in a way that I was kind of amazed by.
Well, it's interesting. You know, you start writing a memoir, right? And it starts to feel like a diary, right? Like only you're going to read it or your friends are going to read it. And I think, you know, the book comes out Tuesday and people are just starting to get copies of it. And I am just starting to realize what it means that people know things about me now.
Coworkers.
Super weird. Yeah. So I'm just going to have to get used to the fact that people are going to know weird things about my sister.
She seemed like a very self-possessed, like in a good way person.
Yes, yes.
Confident.
Yes, but like a lot of family stuff in this book and a lot of... you know, I guess confessions about how I live or when I'm not giving advice. And I'm just going to have to get used to that. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I have to say you show the same sort of candor that people who write to love letters do, except you're using your actual name and not a handle.
Right. I don't get to say like, you know, Restless in Roxbury. I don't get to say that.
But I want to just throw out the number here, the phone number, because I know that a ton of your fans hopefully are listening. And if you have questions for Meredith Goldstein about the genesis of the love letters column or what it's like to be a columnist or I don't know, maybe if you want to get a question in.
Right, need love advice?
Yeah.
Right.
We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK to talk to Meredith Goldstein today. Okay, so I just, you know, I want to explore some of the sort of genesis story that you tell here about how this insanely popular column for The Globe came about because it starts with a man.
It does. And, you know, I mean, I would never say that having a breakup led me to write an advice column. It just happened to be at the same time where I had actually asked to write the advice column. And I was asking really Marty Baron, who now edits The Washington Post, was then editing The Globe. And some of you might have seen portrayed in Spotlight, you know, serious guy, convincing these editors that I really thought The Globe needed a love advice column, which is a tough case to make when newspapers are cutting resources. And
so you went to Marty Baron with this directly?
I, you know, eventually all decisions go to Marty Baron because Marty Baron is somebody who likes to be in on all decisions.
Yeah. And I'm just visualizing this. Like, there he is with his beard and his glasses and his wall full of Pulitzer Prizes.
Oh, yeah. Looking at me like, what does she want again? And, you know, we started it. He was supportive. I think, you know, he said something to the effect of, like, just do the rest of your job, too, and we'll see how this goes. And you know, I think I made the case to him and to other editors that, you know, Boston is very into itself. And, you know, to have syndicated advice columnist is great, but to really get a letter that might be signed like it's from Milton, like that's something else, right? To know that somebody's in Waltham. So this started and I just happened to not be in a really great place in life. And I thought,
can I just ask you to be more specific? Because you are specific.
So there's
a person named Patrick.
Yes. And so I basically... All of this, the love advice column starts not long after I have this office breakup. And I really felt this breakup on a level that I should not have felt it. Not because he wasn't wonderful, but because, you know, I say in the book, I didn't want to marry him. I didn't think this was going to last forever. But I think what it really was that I was, you know, in my early 30s. And when you're that age, there are all these people who have met or not met this deadline, right? This unspoken deadline of coupling up. I didn't want to get married, but I didn't know where I was supposed to be. And every single friend around me was getting married and starting a family. And I thought, well, okay, it's fine that I don't want to do these things, but what happens when I'm like a leftover? Right? So I really think that the timing of that breakup, you know, and the sadness was much more about... What happens to me? And I think a lot of us feel that way at different points in our lives. So I really didn't have a choice, though. At that point, I had pushed so hard to start an advice column that I started to have to do
it. And you're like, let's do it. But it took off almost instantly, though.
I mean,
that's the thing.
It did. And I was really shocked that people didn't say, well, what qualifies you? Or why am I sending it to this woman? Who are you? Immediately, when I put out a call for letters, people were like, oh, good. Here's my problem. There was immediate trust. I think that there's a culture of advice giving that people are used to. Mm-hmm. So they're understanding that they're getting the advice of a writer, you know, a journalist. And, you know, suddenly there were letters coming in. And this first one that
from Rockland, right?
So desperate in Rockland, which is my first letter ever. And, you know, I celebrate that letter. And it's just from a woman who was in a long distance relationship and you know, just needed some advice, and it was a great.
So it's so interesting that the first letter to Love Letters, I think, encapsulates all the reasons why people really love the column. Because you talked about it being interactive, because you solicit advice from readers
as
well.
Yes, on the comment section, like please weigh in with your own advice, disagree with me. You know,
but the stories themselves, the letters themselves, are almost always this combination of like true sincerity, right, and sometimes like shocking honesty. Like you get the sense that they've never talked to anybody about this before. There's always a twist of weird.
Yeah,
a little bit of weird.
I mean, we've all got a little weird.
Yeah, like
right?
In this one, Desperate in Rockland was trying to like get a light up a relationship with someone. Rockland was trying to break break up? Right. Well, she tried to break it up three times.
She's
right.
in this long distance relationship, and she gets the sense that she's not getting the full, you know, just her significant other is just really not letting her in. And
right.
she says, okay, this is where the weird comes in. She says,
I like him, but I find it hard to get to know him. He won't even show me his feet.
There's always a feet comment or something that makes it so unique. And I think one of my first answer was, you deserve someone who will show you his feet if that's what you want in life.
And then use your feet. Perhaps it's time to use your feet to walk away.
Oh, yeah. That was day one. So, and from day one, you know, it started with a few comments, and then there were 30, and then there were 50. And if you can believe it, we were in such a different place with technology back then that I had to approve the comments manually. That only lasted for about a month or two. But, you know, the Globe was still at the end of that technology where I would look and say, oh, look, and I would just hit the button.
Yeah.
It was very time consuming.
Well, we are talking to Meredith Goldstein. She is the brains and the heart behind the Love Letters column in the Boston Globe. She has a new memoir called Can't Help Myself, Lessons and Confessions from a Modern Advice Columnist. And if you have a question for Meredith, you can reach us at 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Now, Meredith, the parts of the book that really kind of opened my eyes and touched me the most where you're really, like you said, you're honest about your family.
Yes.
Tell us about your mom.
So my mom was a wonderful woman who was a Juilliard-trained pianist. And really, we had that, you know, I always say, oh, we were like Gilmore Girls, right? We had that sort of best friend kind of mother-daughter relationship, which has its ups and downs, right? She became single after her divorce really at an age that I started dating. Like, we, you know, in my adolescence sort of timed up to her adolescence. And my older sister at that point, I think, was in, you know, approaching college. And really, I had this all-female household after my parents got divorced. And we were all trying to figure out how to date boys.
Yeah.
And so that, you know, that creates a different kind of like emotional intimacy with a parent. And so we were very close. And a year after I started writing this advice column, which she had been such a fan of, she was diagnosed with cancer mm-hmm. and wound up moving to Boston to get treatment at MGH. So a lot of this book is sort of about writing this advice column, sometimes answering letters about sickness and health and these big, heavy questions, and dealing with it in my real life in a different way.
So that had to be hard sometimes, right? Because, I mean, here you are dealing with the truly heartfelt challenges from thousands of anonymous people. But that's like your professional job, right? And then you're going home and dealing with the challenges of, you know, your mother being gravely ill.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's a part of being an advice columnist that you start to feel like a voyeur and everybody's doing stuff, but you might not be, right? I was single and everybody was coupling and having their own love problems, and I was very focused on a parent, right? So on the one hand, the column gave me this incredible escapism, right? Even for my mother, she would read it every morning, and it was like what we would look forward to. What letters are we going to get? And we would sit in hospital rooms, and it was this incredible reprieve from that. On the other hand, it was very difficult because sometimes I felt like what was happening in my personal life could greatly affect the advice I gave, and I had to be very careful about that.
Yeah.
You know, when you're going through something, it can be hard to see other people's problems with clarity.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you write about how through sort of your mother and your sister kind of provide these interesting opposite poles in terms of the kind of advice that you learned to give through talking to them, right? Your mother's
yes.
like sort of sweetly looking to your advice, or like, you know, she's re-entering the dating pool,
yes.
and you know, at what point in time should she be intimate with someone? Whereas you're telling your sister about like maybe you should be drawing more borders,
yeah,
boundaries.
So my mother was this like very overly romantic, right out of the movies kind of woman, you know, and my sister was wild growing up. You know, she just really did whatever she wanted to do. And she still is that way, which is pretty exciting. So, it, you know, watching those two women in my life just taught me so much. And I think, you know, I'm very lucky.
Now, how much advice have you given over the years that you have failed to follow yourself?
Oh, my gosh, like a lot of it. I mean, you know, the column has made me feel a little bit more accountable about, you know, following through myself. You know, if I want to do something bad and I know I wouldn't advise it, I really just have to say, oh, I imagine the commenters yelling at me. But I think there's also the moment where I tell readers to do all these things that I don't know that I'm brave enough to do myself.
Like not reconnecting with an ex.
Not reconnecting with an ex, that's one. Or I am often in a position to say, go out and meet people. Like go out, spend more time off the couch. And I'm writing that advice from the couch. So I feel like I want to take my own advice more, but it's always easier to advise than to, yeah.
I feel like that's the story of all teaching and parenting and advice giving.
Yeah.
But there's a particular chapter in the book called The Rachels. And
yes.
You write about basically your friendship with young sort of 20-something women.
Yeah, yeah.
And how they seem to be the most distraught of your letter writers.
Well, I was just shocked. I thought that the people who would be the most miserable when they wrote in would be people who were ending marriages of 30 years or had complicated family issues. And that's not the case. Those people tended to actually be pretty optimistic. It was 20-something employed, healthy, attractive letter writers who seemed desperately miserable. And I could not figure it out in the beginning. But then as my own friends, my own peers started to be far less available to me, I started hanging out with the younger people at work. And this is what happens, right? Like, you know, they were just available all the time. And I laugh because a lot of these young women happened to be named Rachel. I think it must have been a very popular name at that time. And what they taught me was that, you know, first of all, millennials are not ruining anything. They are actually so thoughtful that that's why they're stressed out,
yeah.
Right? But that they were a first generation to grow up and to finish school with context, so much context that they're seeing all these social media feeds that let them know everything they're missing out. I mean, when I left school, I didn't know what everybody was doing. I mean,
yeah.
I would sit there with my roommate and we would talk about what other people might be doing, maybe rumors we had heard, but they were seeing a stream of it all day. And so they were constantly in a position of saying, am I doing this right? Am I doing enough? Am I choosing the right thing? Because they saw what they were missing out on. And I thought that was really fascinating, that it forced them to be overly thoughtful and overly panicked sometimes. So in the comment section, when 20-somethings write in, the commenters can be aggressive with them and say, oh, it's not possible to have a problem at 25. Wait until you're 35. You know, it's not hard to be single in 28, but it is. And mm-hmm. I think a lot of us forget that whatever we did in our 20s led us to where we are now.
Yeah. Well, that's a really interesting insight. I hadn't thought of it that way. So just unplug everybody.
Yeah.
Ignorance can be bliss, actually, in some cases, I think. Now, you've said that one of your favorite letters is, when does it get better?
Yes.
Look at that. Why is that?
So there's people ask me, like, what's the hardest question to answer? And it's always, like, the most simple ones, like, you know, my partner broke up with me and I'm sad and I don't know how to get over it. And there just isn't anything I can say. Like, having been through many breakups myself, like, you just sort of need to be, like, held and wrapped in a blanket and fed and that's it. And it's hard to do that with a letter writer. So some of the most complicated questions I can answer easily, but it's this simple, how do I get over my ex, or I'm sad and lonely. It's like, or another one, which is, how do I meet someone? If I knew the answer to that, I would sell it.
And you would be very, very,
yeah,
very
there's,
wealthy.
No answer to that. So it's, it's the classic letters that I love.
I want to get back to your mom here, but just one other quick thing I have to ask you about. So you've been sort of this witness to the evolution of relationships since 2009. Technology all over the place, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I mean, and it's interesting looking back at the column, you see the first time somebody asked me about Tinder, the first time somebody asked me about Instagram, then Snapchat, you see these different, apps and it's fascinating to see how it changes what we expect of our partners.
Yeah. I hope we have enough time here, but I'd like if you could at least read part of a letter that you wrote to readers. This is about your mom.
Sure. So this is a letter, and I promise this book is funny too, but this is a poignant moment. But, over the years, commenters have said so many brave things. And when my mom passed away, I really wanted to talk to them. They were sort of my online community. So I wrote in 2013 a letter to them, which said, I lost my mom yesterday. It was unexpected, sort of. She was actually diagnosed with cancer about a year after I started Love Letters. The cancer wasn't what ended things. It was some weird acute infection. Very random and very rare. Everyone at the hospital looked shocked because they thought she had many years ahead of her. I'm oversharing a bit today because you letter writers are always so exposed in this column, and I get to be nice and private for the most part. 4 years ago, when my mom was diagnosed, we decided she'd move to Boston. She loved it here, and we tried to forget that the cancer was one of the reasons she relocated. During these years, I've had many love letters questions of my own. How can I be fun on a date when I'm anxious about my mom's health? Or yesterday, shortly after she died, was it safe to let ex-boyfriends show up to comfort me? Will their attention confuse me? Because my instinct was to want to stand next to them, remembering a different time when things were easier. Maybe you have some advice for me. I don't know. What I do know is that Jewish people sit Shiva, which is basically a mourning period after death where you sit around. It's probably more complicated than that, but my immediate family isn't very observant. Yesterday, when the doctors asked me if my mom was religious, I explained that she was a musician. She went to Juilliard, and concert halls were churches to her. I know you all hate that I love the movie Twilight, but that's one of the reasons my she loved it. Her piano students loved it because of Debussy. My version of Shiva involves sweatpants, food, and taking a day off from love letters, which entertained her so much. We'll be right back to regular letters on Monday, but for today, I'd like you to do me a favor. My mom was a romantic. She was incapable of cynicism. I'd like you to use today's comment space to tell me a romantic story, post a link to a romantic song, or give me some advice about the questions I mentioned earlier. Thank you for assistance with Shiva, and if you don't mind, please help.
And they did.
And they did. Comments all day.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the great things about the Love Letters community. So, Meredith Goldstein, the new memoirs, Can't Help Myself, Lessons and Confessions from a Modern Advice Columnist. Meredith, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thank you for the column as well.
Thank you.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.